You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Much has been made of the role social media sites have played in the events in Egypt over the last 3 weeks, but there's been little attention to how much mosques have factored into the protests, not just as religious centers, but they've also served as makeshift hospitals and meeting places for protesters. Joining me now for a look at that story is Fawaz Jerjes, professor of Middle Eastern politics and international relations at the London School of Economics. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hello.
It's my pleasure. How are you?
I'm okay. The people we've been speaking with have stressed that this is a largely secular protest. Is looking at the role of mosques in these protests necessarily the same as looking at the role of religion?
Yes and no. I think what's really unique about the Intifada in Tunisia and Egypt and Algeria and Yemen, it is spearheaded by the middle class, centrists, professionals, activists, human rights advocates, independent Islamists, and the Muslim Brotherhood. There are no clerics. There are no mullahs like the ones that participated in the Iranian Revolution of the late 1970s. And this is really because, as you know, in the Arab world, the dominant narrative basically posited a polarity of narratives. You have the governments on the one side, the authoritarian regimes, and the Islamists. What the new Intifada has shown is that there is a third alternative. The middle class is a very powerful, basically, constituency, whether it's in Egypt or Tunisia and in other Arab countries as well.
But don't the mosques also serve as community centers, not just as religious centers?
You're absolutely correct. And remember, 2 weeks ago, most of the protests basically emerged out of the mosques after Friday's prayer. And this tells you that even though the government can suppress civil society, civil society associations, secular activists, they can never basically shut down the mosques. And the reality is the mosque remains a highly powerful and independent agency, whether it's in Tunisia or Algeria or Egypt or Jordan, in almost every Arab and Muslim country.
And we've seen bigger numbers of protesters on the streets in many of these countries on Fridays after evening prayers. Why Fridays? There are evening prayers every night.
Yes, but remember, Friday is, I mean, it's really, the for Muslims, it's the Sunday for Christians and the Saturday for Jews. It's the prayer day. It's the most important day for Muslims. And the reality is you have millions of Egyptians and millions of Muslims who basically go to mosques on Friday.
Who may not go during the weekdays.
Absolutely. So Friday is the day. It's the most important day in the week. And that's why 2 weeks ago, Friday was a pivotal moment in Egypt. You had hundreds of thousands of Egyptians who basically tried to participate in the unrests that basically unraveled the Mubarak security apparatus.
Now, are sermons being delivered during Friday prayers that are encouraging them to go to the streets, or are organizers just taking advantage of the fact that many people already be gathered in the mosques for prayers?
The reality, nothing really happens during the Friday prayers, and that's what I'm really trying to stress, is that the mosques serve as an avenue for mobilization, for association, for gathering. You have a large number of Egyptians, but basically, and they take off after the Friday prayers. But I think what's distinctive for your listeners, what's distinctive about the Arab Intifada, whether in Tunisia or Algeria or Egypt, it is really quite a centrist, middle-class, professional-based Intifada.
Uh-huh.
The middle class in particular, the educated students, professionals who basically have served as the spearhead. And this is very unique because the conventional wisdom about Arab politics says, well, only Islamists have the ability to mobilize. Only Islamists like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, the most powerful religiously based organization, has the capacity to challenge the government. The reality in the last 3 weeks, 4 weeks, the reality is that Arab politics is much more complex than the received wisdom.
Now, what about the poor? What about the poor? Are they more likely to be in support of the Mubarak government, or just not even, or just apolitical?
Well, usually you do have the politically conscious and the middle class and the professionals, not just in Egypt, in every society. It's the middle class and the politically conscious who really lead social upheaval and revolutions. What's happening now, and this is what's fascinating, it has taken almost more than 2 weeks for workers and teachers and the poor classes to join the protest, in particular in the last few days. And this really changes the balance of social forces. In particular, you have millions of workers in Egypt. Let me give you an example of what I mean when you say the poor. Egypt is a country of 84 million people. It's the most populous Arab state. Out of the 84 million Egyptians, you have 40% who live either in poverty or below the poverty line. If you have, I mean, imagine, so we're talking about more than 30 million Egyptians. If the Intifada succeeds in mobilizing a small fraction of this particular huge constituency, you're going to have a revolution on your hands. And in the last few days, we are seeing more and more poor Egyptians and workers and lower middle class basically joining the protest. If this thing takes off, if the poor fully joins the Intifada, I think basically this would change the balance of forces and basically would present the Mubarak regime with an existential threat.
In Egypt, all mosques must be licensed by the government, which appoints and pays the imams who lead the prayers. Is that a way for the government to know what's going on? And has that kept the mosques generally apolitical?
Absolutely. Not only it appoints the preachers, the clerics, it pays their salaries, and they have to basically vet their sermons every Friday with the interior ministry or the security apparatus. And that's why I said earlier that basically the Friday prayers basically are apolitical. And the Egyptians and other Arabs know this very well. In fact, after the Tunisian Intifada, on the first day after the Tunisian president Ben Ali left Tunisia, many Tunisians said that was the best Friday prayer in the last 20 or 30 years, because preachers and clerics felt freer to basically speak their minds and talk about really matters that basically are very critical to Tunisians. And we're having the same effects in Egypt today. In the last 2 weeks, we are seeing a large number of clerics and preachers who have joined the protest. Really, one of the most moving scenes in the last few days in at Tahrir Square, the Liberation Square, you have Christian clerics and Muslim clerics joining ranks and basically singing songs about the unity of Christians and Muslims in Egypt.
This follows quite a bit of tension between Muslims and Christians. There were fights between the cops and Muslims in the months leading up to this. So has that all been eased during
yes.
the protests?
I mean, that's the point. What I'm trying to say is that really Egyptians in the last 2 weeks and half, Egyptians are finally getting to know one another. There's a unity of vision, a unity of ranks. A very moving scene. In fact, many Egyptians believe that the security apparatus played a key role in fueling sectarian tensions, because that played into its hands. And the reality, I'm not saying that there were no tensions, but the scenes in the liberation, the Tahrir Square, really show very clearly that Egyptians are finally getting to know one another. And this is really one of the most important lessons of what has happened in Egypt. And now you're seeing judges, attorneys, professors, teachers, workers. What the Intifada has done is to really bring Egyptians closer and to unite them in opposition to the Mubarak regime. And the more the Mubarak regime tries to lash out, to crack down against the protesters, the bigger the crowds, I would argue. And yesterday's was really a big day. Yesterday, hundreds of thousands of Egyptians came out to show the regime that the Intifada is not a spent force, that the Intifada is here to stay. And that's why I would argue that this is really the beginning, not the end, of what we are seeing in Tunisia and in Egypt and other Arab countries.
We're talking about the role of mosques in the protests throughout the Middle East with Fawaz Jerjes, professor of Middle Eastern politics and international relations at the London School of Economics. Well, on paper, Egypt is a secular country, but doesn't its constitution say that no law can contradict Sharia law?
Well, it says that is according to the Sharia law. It doesn't say the Sharia law. It doesn't say the Islamic law. So there is a leeway. And in fact, one of the reasons that the late President Anwar Sadat was assassinated by militant Islamists, because they believe that he pledged to change the constitution from to the Sharia, to add this, that the Sharia, the Islamic law, would become the law governing Egyptian society. So in this particular sense, and many Egyptians now are saying that they want to enshrine the law of citizenship in the new constitution. They want to make it more inclusive, more pluralistic, more democratic, and take into account that citizenship, not any particular law, should be the guiding principle of the new Egypt.
But I've been hearing that the country has become more conservative over the last 30 years and as a result, also more religious. Is that not true?
You're absolutely correct, not just Egypt. I think in the last 30, 40 years, we have seen most Arab countries become very religious, not just Muslims. You have Christians and you have Jews as well. Really, the rise of, you might say, religious sentiments, the rise of fundamentalist sentiments throughout the region. And the reality is, It's easy to explain. Societies in moments of duress fall back on what? They fall back on basically ideas and values that are very dear to their societies. When institutions are decimated, when you don't have institutions that basically mediate between and among citizens, what do you have? People basically fall back at their own provincial and local institutions. So you have the rise of Coptic sentiments. The church became a state within a state. The mosque became a state within a state. As a result of really the destruction of institutions in Arab societies, and also as a result of the dismal economic and social conditions. The reason why the middle class in Egypt and Tunisia and other Arab countries basically is spearheading the revolt, you're talking about devastating social conditions. On average, I mean, think about it. Even in America, when people say the Arab world, people think of the Gulf. They think of the sheikhs and the gulfs, of the oil, of the gas, of the billions of dollars, which is true. But this is the oil-producing Gulf is entirely different from the non-producing Arab region that includes most of the Arabs. On average, and probably I am a bit exaggerating, you have between 40 and 50%. The 300 million Arabs live either in poverty or below the poverty line on less than $2 a day. For example, in Yemen, Yemen is a country of 23 million people. You have almost 60% of Yemenis live either in poverty or below the poverty lines. Egypt, millions of Egyptians wait for hours to get six loaves of bread, subsidized loaves of bread. Cairo is a city of 22 million people. You have 10 million Egyptians who live in the so-called urban poverty belts. I don't need to tell you what the urban poverty belts are. They're basically a hellish place. No sanitation, no water, no... this is really literally hell. You have 1.5 million of Egyptians in Cairo live in cemeteries. 1 million live on the roofs of buildings. This is how bad the situation. While you have abject poverty, you have decadent wealth, millions and billions, in particular the marriage between the political class and the business class. And this particular marriage has really alienated the middle class and the professional class and the poor. And that's why the anger and the rage in Egypt, because they realize while, I mean, millions of Egyptians are starving, you have a tiny small class that basically has accumulated huge, huge wealth in the last 10 or 15 years.
So are the business class quaking in their boots right now?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, imagine now, I would argue, regardless of what happens, you're going to see a restructuring of both the political and economic class in Egypt. I think the rise of the middle class basically will have tremendous impact on Egyptian domestic politics, economic policies, and foreign policy as well. I mean, the numbers, as you well know, the numbers that we are seeing in terms of corruption. Corruption has infiltrated every aspect of Egyptian life. The estimate of just the Mubarak family wealth ranges between $40 billion and $70 billion. You have hundreds of business people who are affiliated with the Mubarak regime who have accumulated tens of billions of dollars basically as a result of corruption and deals that and regardless of the extent of the numbers, and of course we don't have really correct estimates and statistics about the numbers, but the reality, the overwhelming number of Egyptians believe that they are critical inequities that go to the very heart of the social uprising, the social intifada, or the revolution that has erupted in Egypt in the last 3 weeks.
In Jordan, where we've seen protests over the last three Fridays, imams are also appointed by the state, which also pays mosque staff salaries and oversees the construction of mosques. I'm assuming a way of controlling political activity there as well. And yet we've been seeing thousands of Jordanians taking to the streets to protest the government and the rising prices of food and fuel. Is it significant that the countries we've been talking about, Jordan, Yemen, Tunisia, Egypt, are all mainly Sunni? Would political Islam look different if we were talking about Shiite-dominated countries like Iran or Lebanon, where Hezbollah, a Shiite group, has just become the ruling party?
I know you, the focus of the segment is mosques and the role of mosques in the Intifada in the Arab world. Mm-hmm. In the 1970s, as you know, during the Iranian Revolution, we talked about the relationship between Shiite Islam and basically dissidency and revolution. Many books were written on the exceptionalism of Shiite Islam as a revolutionary force. And many people said the difference between Shiite Islam and Sunni Islam was not as revolutionary as Shiite Islam. What you are seeing today is, in fact, I would not say it's Sunni Islam. I would say really more of a democratic wave. The democratic wave has finally reached the Arab shores. This is not about Shiite Islam or really Sunni Islams. This is about basically what I call the rise of new sentiments, the rise of new classes, the inability of the government to control information, the ability of a satellite channel like Al Jazeera to basically disseminate information in Tunisia and Egypt to really tell the people what's happening in their societies, the power of the internet, the web, Twitter. Those are modern tools that have basically awakened populations in villages and small towns and urban cities. So in a way, while it's critical to say that the mosque remains a place where people gather, where people mobilize, where people meet, where people talk, the reality is the tools of this particular revolution are really modern. They are democratic. I mean, during the Iranian Revolution, the mullahs and the clerics used cassettes, video cassettes and audio cassettes in order to communicate with populations throughout Iran. Today, they're using the internet and Twitter and Al Jazeera. In Tunisia, after Ben Ali left Tunis, the protesters kept saying, "Thank you, Al Jazeera, for connecting Tunisians together. Yes, we can." I called it the Obama generation because you have a new revival, a new awakening. In a way, really, to me, what's happening in the Arab world is a belated democratic wave two decades later after Eastern Europe, the fall of the Berlin Wall. Because of the modern, the globalization that basically destroyed the traditional control mechanisms, the authoritarian mechanisms installed by Arab regimes in the last 30 years.
The Muslim Brotherhood is the best-known Muslim opposition group in Egypt and in some other countries as well, where it's also been suppressed. Are there others?
Oh, absolutely. The Muslim Brotherhood is the most powerful organized Islamist organization. Within the Islamist universe, you have multiple faces, many faces of Islam. You have independent Islamists. You have a Salafi movement, Salafi in English means ancestors, who are basically apolitical. And the government in the last 5-6 years, in particular after 9/11, tried to really encourage the Salafi Islam, which is a very apolitical, a very passive political, but very highly conservative, similar to the Salafi Islam that exists in Saudi Arabia. So you have many faces of political Islam, yet, again, I'm going to stress the big point I'm trying to make. What's unique, what's distinctive about the Intifada, about the revolution in the Arab world, this is really more of a liberal-leaning, middle-class, professional-based Intifada. In fact, the Islamists belatedly joined the Intifada, in particular the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah, actually, and the Muslim Brotherhood said today that it won't field a presidential candidate. Over the weekend, they were criticized for backing down from their calls for Mubarak's immediate departure.
I mean, yes, because there is a great deal of suspicion of the Muslim Brotherhood, in particular among the middle class and the various liberal-leaning and centrist organizations. They realize that the Muslim Brotherhood would make deals even with the hated Mubarak regime. Remember, if there is one particular fundamental goal that basically fuels the Muslim Brotherhood is for them to become fully integrated into the political process. They want to become legitimized within the system because they are, as you well know, they are illegal. They are banned since 1954. And the government has waged a relentless war against the Muslim Brotherhood. So they'll do anything to be accepted, to be integrated. But the reality is the Muslim Brotherhood has shown maturity and realism and restraint. Even just today, they said that the Muslim Brotherhood is not interested in power, will not basically field a presidential candidate. They're trying to reassure the Egyptian public and the Egyptian army and also the international community that there is nothing to fear from the Muslim Brotherhood. Remember what happened in Algeria in 1990, 1991, 92, when the Islamists won an outright victory in the elections. And what the army did after that, basically cracked down brutally against the Islamists. And the Muslim Brotherhood is fully conscious of the Algerian model. They do not really want the army to intervene and suppress the Muslim Brotherhood. That's why they're trying to seize the moment and show maturity and realism.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Fawaz Jajess is professor of Middle Eastern Politics and International Relations at the London School of Economics.